That's Detroit-born jazz violinist Regina Carter, cousin of saxophonist, or saxophonist, for those who say it that way, James Carter, serving up a sweet version of Eddie Harris's Listen Here from her 1997 album dedicated to her mother Grace, titled Something for Grace. Regina's father, Dan, worked at the Ford Motor Company, and her mother was a kindergarten teacher. She began studying violin at the age of 4 at the Detroit Community School, and as a teenager performed with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. She studied classical violin at the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston, and then returned to her community to teach strings in Detroit's public schools. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, January the 28th, the day after the much ballyhooed State of the Union address. Well, let's just say it could wait. It can wait, trust me. Today, we present to you another installment in our continuing coverage of Detroit. Our guest is Abayomi Azikiwe, who has filed several reports with us on what's been happening in his city. Today he addresses the question, what's behind the emergency management and forced bankruptcy of Detroit? To refresh your memory, Abayomi is the editor of the Pan-African Newswire. He's a Detroit organizer for the Workers' World Party and an organizer-activist with Moratorium Now, a grassroots group that has been seeking to halt foreclosures, evictions, and utility cutoffs for struggling Detroiters. So here's how we're going to do it today. He will present his tome, and we'll talk about 30, 35 minutes or so, and then we'll open up the phone lines for your questions. Abayomi, what a joy it is to have you with us today. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I want to thank Lead Stories and PRN-FM for paying such close attention to the situation in the city of Detroit. In this broadcast today, I want to discuss the current situation in the city of Detroit from the perspective of someone who has lived since childhood in the city over the last 46 years. The thrust of the narrative on Detroit is being crafted by the corporate media, who is acting as cheerleaders and spin doctors for the bankers and the bosses whose policies are at the root of the crisis. And that narrative has been to blame the unions, the retirees, the politicians, and the poor for the crisis in Detroit. My purpose here is to present an alternative perspective on the recent history of this majority African-American city. Now, since late March of 2013, the city of Detroit has been under a so-called financial emergency. The right-wing, multimillionaire governor, Rick Snyder, designated Kevin Orr, who has acted as an agent for the banks and the corporate community for many years. He was appointed to head the municipality of the city of Detroit in total contravention of the political will of the people, not only here in the city, but around the state of Michigan. When the announcement of emergency management was made in March of 2013, the corporate media never bothered to mention that a large majority of people within Michigan had just voted against Proposal 2, which would have changed the Constitution to ensure payments to the banks, irrespective of the interests of the people of this area. What did the state legislation and, the governor of Michigan do in December of 2013, December of 2012, during a period where it was a lame duck session? They passed yet another bill quite similar to the one that was voted against by the electorate in Michigan. This bill was called Public Act 436, and it remains referendum-proof because it was passed as an attachment to an appropriations bill. Public Act 436 is nothing but a legislative and executive mechanism to further impoverish, exploit, oppress, and repress the people of Detroit. Over the last census period, some 237,000 people were driven from the city through predatory lending, the utility shutoffs, the flight of jobs, and political and state repression. When the city loses residents, it means that tax revenues go down, and this inevitably results in a greater drain of resources for the payment of civil servants and the maintenance of municipal services like public lighting, public transportation, public schools, etc. The banks who evicted the residents of Detroit do not pay taxes on the seized property, many of which now are controlled by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who are deadbeat property occupiers themselves. At present, there's no viable or legitimate government running the city of Detroit. The current corporate-imposed mayor, the majority members on the Detroit City Council, voted to abdicate their authority to the state and consequently the banks which have run the city of Detroit. Just last year, the outgoing mayor, who now has been replaced by Mike Duggan, who was initially a resident of Livonia, a suburb outside the city of Detroit, who ran as a write-in candidate and who spent $3 million on a campaign for a job that pays less than $250,000 a year. The mayor and also the majority on the city council have voted consistently to hand over millions upon millions of dollars to Jones Day Law Firm, a multi-billion dollar outfit that was involved in the much-championed Chrysler bailout during 2009. Jones Day, which is the former firm of emergency manager Kevin Orr, is now effectively managing affairs in the city of Detroit. Now, these forces, which are the enablers behind emergency manager Orr, were part of the auto prepackaged bankruptcy of 2009 that led to the loss of tens of thousands of auto jobs, the slashing of salaries, the institutionalization of a two- and a three-tier wage structure in auto, and attacks on the eight-hour day, which are taking place now in the industry. Jones Day Law Firm is being contracted to supposedly restructure the debt for the city. We know that whatever they decide to do would not involve the people of Detroit. We also know that the type of restructuring they are talking about has nothing to do with the interests of the people of the city, which includes the needs for jobs, economic opportunity, housing rehabilitation, municipal services, the rebuilding of public education, public transportation, to develop food security, the maintenance of the water system in Detroit, as well as other public assets. Now, just to talk about some of the historical background dealing with the crisis in the city of Detroit, we all know that Detroit is a city that has been in the national and world news since last year, when Governor Rick Snyder declared a so-called financial emergency in the city. Therefore, he set the stage for the appointment of an emergency manager. Now, many press reports drew a direct connection between the recent corruption trial of the former mayor, Kwame Kilpatrick, who was sentenced to 28 years in federal prison, and his friend and businessman, Bobby Ferguson. In fact, just prior to Snyder's declaration, Kilpatrick and Ferguson were found guilty of numerous corruption charges in a month-long federal trial. Of course, the corporate and government-controlled media has never focused on who are the real culprits in the underdevelopment and consequent destruction of Detroit and other majority African-American municipalities in Michigan. These media entities fall back on the same notions that have prevailed inside the United States since the period of Reconstruction, and that is African-American political leadership is inherently corrupt and inefficient, rendering them incapable of managing the affairs of governments locally, statewide, and nationally. Beginning in the late 1990s, the city was the focus of one of the largest swindles in the history of the United States. Predatory lending schemes targeting African Americans and Latino communities in a massive profit-making project that involved the highest echelons of finance capital in collusion, however, with the federal, state, and local governmental authorities. African Americans were deliberately lured into these first home buyer and refinancing programs, which the banks knew well in advance would result in massive home losses and the wholesale leveling and cleansing of neighborhoods and cities. These predatory lending programs, in many cases, were racist in character. By only providing subprime loans to African Americans and Latinos, even if they qualified for what was considered a conventional mortgage. The largest and most profitable banks and insurance companies were involved in these efforts. Even though many of the mortgage loans appear to originate from small real estate and finance companies, over a period of time, the servicing of these loans wound up with some of the oldest and well-established banks, such as J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, the Royal Bank of Scotland, which is Charter One in the United States, Wells Fargo, the Bank of New York Mellon Trust, and others. The forces behind these fraudulent mortgage packages were the so-called securitized trusts and hedge funds, many of which are based on Wall Street in New York City. The mortgages were bundled up in exotic financial instruments and backed up by multi-billion-dollar firms such as the American International Group, AIG. Utilizing credit default swaps, these trusts and funds bet on the fact that there would be a monumental and unprecedented foreclosure crisis, and they reap trillions of dollars in profits based upon the failure and destruction of municipalities throughout the United States. In late 2006 and early 2007, these schemes began to unravel. Two Detroit-based attorneys associated with the Michigan Emergency Committee Against War and Injustice, McCowery, began to receive requests to defend hundreds of people from imminent foreclosure. What they discovered shortly was that people had been placed in adjustable-rate mortgages, the so-called ARMs, where they would start off paying a relatively manageable amount in a monthly payment, only to see these installments rise precipitously over a brief period of time. Eventually, the homeowner would not be able to make payments. They would fall behind, and then a series of late fees and penalties would take hold, leading to default, foreclosure, and seizure by the banks. Many of these foreclosures and evictions were illegal, even according to the rules set out by the banks themselves. Options that should have been available to lower payments and to work out agreements with the banks were disregarded in the mad rush for repossession of the homes. It later became clear that there were greater incentives for the banks to foreclose on these borrowers than work with them to resolve the payment issues. Most of these fraudulent mortgages were insured at the inflated rates of the mortgages as opposed to the actual market rate of the properties, which were rapidly declining in value. When foreclosures occurred, the banks would be paid the full value plus penalties and fees by the insurers, therefore making profits on both ends. What helped fuel the predatory lending frenzy was also the false notion that property values would continue to rise in perpetuity. Lenders would tell borrowers that they could always refinance and get lower interest rates and more cash. This, of course, turned out to be a big lie, because as soon as the system began to unravel in 2007 and property values plunged, no lender would be willing to refinance. People were stuck with homes that were declining in value, with high, unreasonable mortgage payments, surrounded by communities that were being destroyed through the crisis. Now, let us look at how the economic restructuring of the United States over the last several decades has specifically impacted workers, particularly African-American workers in a city like Detroit. Let us now look at some of the underlying factors that are clearly related to the crisis of housing in the urban areas like Detroit. Now, since the 1970s, wages have been on a decline inside the United States. With large-scale deindustrialization in Detroit and other cities throughout Michigan, the problem of structural unemployment has become pronounced. This problem, in fact, goes back to the 1950s, when the general myth exists of an expanding economy with a burgeoning middle class is still promoted in the mass media and the popular culture. In Detroit, industrial jobs were being lost in the 1950s and the 1960s, as the census reports well document. This was taking place at the same time as the large-scale migration of African Americans into the city of Detroit was increasing, when many working-class and middle-class whites were fleeing the city for the suburbs. By the time of the 1967 rebellion, the decline in the city was well underway. Unemployment and underemployment was a major problem among youth in the African American community in Detroit, even as early as 1967, when approximately 40% of the city was black. There was a minor recession in 1969, and in 1971, the Nixon administration embarked upon its anti-inflation program that took the U.S. off the gold standard. By 1973 and 1974, major changes in the economic structures of the country resulted in plant closings and layoffs. The October 1973 Egypt-Israeli war prompted the Arab oil embargo that brought about additional shocks in the petroleum industry, which resulted in price hikes and shortages in fuel. The problems of large-scale unemployment began during this period in the city of Detroit and in other industrial centers around the United States. In 1975, there was a major restructuring of the world economic system. And even a greater degree of deindustrialization began to occur, where millions of people were thrust into economic uncertainty and social displacement. These developments occurred within a broader international context that had a tremendous impact on the U.S. 1975 was the same year that the Vietnam War and the influence of Washington collapsed in Southeast Asia. Also that same year, there was the independence of Angola and Mozambique in southern Africa, which crippled the U.S., one of its main allies within NATO, the nation of Portugal, whose government had plunged into crisis in Europe. These factors were compounded with the fall of the Nixon administration the year before, and the revelations surrounding the role of domestic intelligence services hampered the ability of the state to exercise a degree of repression that had been common since the Cold War between 1947 and 1974. When jobs are lost and people move from cities, this impacts the tax base and the very existence of small and medium-sized businesses. The rate of profitability, even among the large multinational corporations, declined during the mid to late 1970s, therefore perpetuating the cycle of joblessness and increasing impoverishment. In the city of Detroit, the subprime mortgage phenomena and the consequent foreclosure and eviction crisis had a compounding effect on the city's tax base. The 2000 to 2010 census figures indicate that some 237,000 people were forced out of the city of Detroit. That was one quarter of the overall population of Detroit. Many of these people were byproducts of the economic devolution of the city and the United States. There were 150,000 foreclosures in the Detroit metropolitan area during this period, and the simultaneous loss of jobs and the decline in real wages proved to be even more devastating to the city. Another dimension of this crisis related to the fiscal health of the city of Detroit is the municipal finance problems that have been developing over the last decade. With the decline in tax revenue and revenue sharing from both the states and the federal government, the city was forced to rely on borrowing through disadvantageous loans and bond issues. Recently released documents under the Freedom of Information Act lawsuit that was filed by the Moratorium Now Coalition to stop foreclosures, evictions, and utility shutoffs has brought about the exposure of the fraudulent activity carried out by the same banks that drove nearly a quarter of a million people out of the city through mortgage lending and home seizures. The use of credit default swaps in municipal finance has resulted in the complete financial ruin of the city. The existence of $16.9 billion in long-term debt for the city of Detroit stems directly from these same bond issues and loans that are held by Bank of America, U.S. Bank, USB, and others. The emergency manager laws, both Public Act 4, which was a predecessor to Public Act 436, which was overturned through a statewide referendum in November of 2012, and the new law, Public Act 436, allows for the emergency managers to tear up labor contracts, to tear up vendor agreements, but does not allow the debts supposedly owed to the banks not to be paid. In other words, the emergency manager laws provide a pseudo-legal rationale for the dictatorship of the banks over the city. Even though the people throughout the state of Michigan voted down Public Act 4, Snyder and his cohorts in Lansing reinstituted an even worse law, giving it immunity from repeal by the electorate. Nonetheless, the existence of emergency management will not result in the improvement of city services. The advent of new jobs which pay a living wage or the empowerment of the working class and the national press is the only solution. In fact, this Public Act 436, the imposition of emergency management and the forced bankruptcy of the city, is doing just the opposite of what needs to be done. On April 16th of last year, the Detroit City Council, in a majority vote of 5-2, agreed to allow Jones Day Law Firm, which Kevin Orr, the emergency manager, worked for until recently, to implement a contract worth $3.2 million to ostensibly work towards the restructuring of the debt. It is quite obvious that any restructuring will not be in the interest of the people of Detroit, but to further disempower and enslave the workers and the oppressed in perpetual debt and dictatorship under the financial institutions. It was revealed in the limited debate surrounding the Jones Day contract that this law firm is involved in representing the same banks that hold the municipal debt for the city of Detroit. Therefore, how can they represent the people of Detroit when they are in league with their mortal enemies? Jones Day was involved in the Chrysler bailout and bankruptcy of 2009. Although General Motors and Chrysler restructuring are championed by the corporate media as a success, the fact of the matter is that tens of thousands of people lost their jobs during the process, including production workers and car dealerships, which were closed en masse. Of course, they have the same agenda for the people of the city of Detroit. City pension funds are a source of revenue that can be taken over by the emergency manager. And, of course, this is becoming a major issue in the bankruptcy trial. Now, even though Kevin Orr got his way in bankruptcy court on December 3rd, and Judge Stephen Rhodes said that the city was eligible for bankruptcy, another major trial later on that month over whether or not Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, and UBS should be paid off outside the bankruptcy at a rate of 80% to the dollar, when in fact it has been proposed that retirees be paid as low as 16 cents to the dollar. This trial, of course, ended in disaster for Jones Day Law Firm because Judge Stephen Rhodes, after weighing the arguments from attorneys, principally Jerry Goldberg, representing a Detroit retiree, David Soule, who is a organizer for the Stop the Theft of Our Pensions Committee and the Moratorium Now Coalition, and another attorney, English, representing a bond insurer, they both argued successfully that this deal that was to be financed by Barclays Banks to the tune of some $3.5 billion was not in the best interest of the city of Detroit, and that the entire swap deal that originated in 2005 and was revived in 2009 had questionable legality. In fact, the judge in his ruling said that the city of Detroit could very well have a very good chance of winning in court and holding these banks accountable and therefore having the swaps terminated based upon the illegality. Now, within the context of the discussions and reports printed by the corporate media and broadcast over the radio and television, there's never any questions raised about the failure of finance capital and the federal government to create jobs and small businesses, but to do just the opposite. Today, the banks are sitting on $2 trillion in cash, but will not invest in job creation because it is more profitable for these entities to invest in production and services overseas where wages are lower and benefit scales are often non-existent. Listening to President Barack Obama's State of the Union address for 2014, this, of course, comes to mind. He talks about the growing gap between working class people and the poor versus the extremely wealthy, but yet no programs to create jobs, to generate small business, to create more social spending, to take the weight of the economic crisis off the working people and the poor and the national press is being advanced by the administration or by the Congress, nor by the corporate community themselves who are responsible for the crisis. Therefore, little is to be expected from the halls of Congress, from the White House, and from the corporate boardrooms. Any solution to the economic crisis in Detroit, as well as around the United States, has to come from the people themselves. The developments in Detroit merely prefigures what is already going on at lower levels and sometimes on greater levels in other municipalities around the United States, and indeed among industrial countries throughout the world. Just take a cursory glance at developments in Southern Europe, in Greece, in Spain, in Portugal, where unemployment rates are hovering above 25%, where retirees have had their pensions cut, where mass poverty is becoming the norm. Since Detroit is a majority African-American city and has a heroic history of labor and national struggles, the tendency is to make it appear as if the people themselves, through their trade unions and their community organizing, are the cause of the suffering, the blight, and the debt. However, one has to drive through suburban communities as well and witness some of the same problems related to home foreclosures, the closing of small businesses, and the evisceration of municipal and educational services. In various cities throughout the United States, including Stockton and San Bernardino, California, Providence, Rhode Island, Jefferson County, Alabama, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Suffolk County, New York, and others, municipalities are facing similar problems. In Stockton, which has filed for Chapter 9 bankruptcy protection as well, the creditors, represented by the banks and the bond insurers, recently attempted to declare that there was no financial crisis and that the city should pay them first and disregard the pension funds of municipal employees. The same arguments are being made throughout the United States. The banks are setting policies for the cities by demanding and acquiring first lien on all tax dollars that should be going towards maintaining municipal services, pensions, and public schools. Some 15 years ago, Detroiters were being told that the building of casinos would generate the necessary revenue that could bring a city back from decades of decline resulting from capital flight, population decline, and the erosion of the urban infrastructures. However, the situation today is represented by the fact that the banks are claiming billions in debt from the city of Detroit, and consequently the financial institutions take tax revenue from the casinos, which are placed with a trustee in order to pay off obligations to these same elements of capital. Of course, in concluding, I would just like to point out that the federal government is complicit in the destruction of the city. The tendency of blaming local communities for their own problems often overlooks the role of the federal government in the present crisis. In regard to housing, it is clear that for the past two decades, the Congress and the administration have systematically worked to eradicate low-income public housing. Most of the public housing projects which were built for people during the 1930s, the 1940s, and the 1950s have been razed. In Chicago, the Robert Taylor Homes, the Ida B. Wells Homes, the Cabrini Green complexes have all been shut down and demolished. In Detroit, the Brewster projects and the Jeffries projects have been torn down and replaced with housing that most poor and low-income people cannot afford. The promised new housing for the most marginalized sections of the working class has never materialized in the United States. Of course, these projects were designed from the beginning for racist purposes. With the migration of African Americans from the rural areas of the South to the urban North and the West, there was resistance to housing integration that was fostered heavily by the ruling class. This policy served at least two purposes. They contained the African American and Latino communities in confined geographic areas, and at the same time, it provided the political capacity to convince the white working class and the middle class that they were somehow superior to the nationally oppressed groups, due to the better conditions of residence and services that were allocated. This concerted division of the working class inside the United States created the conditions for the ultimate crushing of the trade unions and the evolution of a genuine people's movement that could cut across racial lines. Nonetheless, the dumping of millions of people with the major shift in housing policy in the 1990s exacerbated the homeless problem, as well as fostered the decline of the cities and the forced remigration of African Americans back to the South and to working-class suburbs surrounding the large urban areas. With the removal of low-income housing, many people could not afford to live in the cities. And as a result of this phenomenon, it prompted the gentrification of the cities where the upper middle class and the wealthy sectors were able to come in to reoccupy sections of the central city. The problem of these policies is that the capitalist system is in deep crisis. Consequently, the financial interests are not in a position to invest the necessary money to actually rebuild the cities in their own images. And we'll stop there for now. But this hopefully will give you some insight into the complexity and the depth of the crisis in the city of Detroit and how the crisis in the city of Detroit relates to the overall crisis of the cities throughout the United States and how this crisis relates to the overall world crisis of modern-day capitalism. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you very much, Abuyomi. I want you to, of course, take a little rest, and we will now open up the phone lines after this very short musical break. Your questions at 888-874-4888 for Abuyomi Azikiwe, who has just answered the question, what's behind the emergency management and forced bankruptcy of Detroit? Right after this. Abuyomi, that was a very comprehensive treatment that you gave us, and it allowed us to connect several dots, but also to see the issue of Detroit in a much larger world. It is not just the city of Detroit having this problem all by itself. It is connected to so many other things.
Yes, that is correct. And the last point, of course, related to the role of the federal government and coming on the heels of the State of the Union address last evening, I emphasized that the Obama administration often talks about the need to create jobs, but in fact, there's really no systematic program to do so. And this is a major crisis throughout the United States. The Congress could not even agree last month to extend unemployment benefits to the long-term unemployed. I don't know where they think people are going to get money to stay in their homes and their apartments, to buy food, to put gasoline in their cars, or to take public transportation. So I think it's a political crisis in addition to the economic crisis, political from the standpoint that the powers that be have no real solution to this crisis.
We go to Los Angeles. DX, you're on the air.
Hello, Yatri. How's your day going?
Fine, thank you.
Good. Thank you, Aviomi Ezekiel, for being on the show today, brother.
Thank you.
Giving us this information. I have a question. How do we, because, okay, I'm in Los Angeles, okay? California has a couple of cities that are next on the chopping block. And I do believe that Detroit is the model they're going to use.
Yes.
Now, I also know a couple of people here from the city of Detroit or who have lived there. And whenever I talk to them about this situation here with what's happening with the city, they always have this discombobulated thinking, and they don't know the real story. They always say, they always point out the corrupt mayor, Kilpatrick, and they do the whole talking points of what they hear on the media. So that's the crux of my question. Okay, people, not everybody listens to stations like PRN where you get the unfiltered truth. And I believe that the media does this on purpose. And so my question to you, and I'd like to point out another example first, though.
This is relevant,
Yatri. A few months ago, see, I'm just trying to illustrate how people don't really pay attention and things like that. A few months ago in San Francisco, there was an incident where a guy got on a train with a gun, and so many people are looking down at their iPods and phones and things. Nobody even noticed he was waving the gun around. I don't know if you heard about that. But
yes, you saw it. I saw it.
So people are transfixed on this multimedia, corporate media, and gadgets. So my question to Mr. Ezekiel is, how do you think we can effectively get the true message to people in this day and age where it's all corrupted in the mainstream media and they have these gadgets and things? How do we get around that?
Well, that's the trillion-dollar question of the day. How do we change the narrative? And that was the purpose of this presentation today, to articulate a different set of principles and realities that exist. Mm-hmm. It's always been the objective of the corporate media and the ruling class and those who work for them to always blame the people for their plight. And this is a classic example of it in regard to what's going on in Detroit. Now, in terms of the corruption of the Kilpatrick administration, it existed. I'm not trying to justify anything that he did. But I think it was relatively minor in the overall crisis in the city. In fact, most of the laws that he was accused and convicted of breaking related to private funds. They were not related to the embezzlement of public money. And plus, Kwame Kilpatrick does not own a bank. He does not own a financial institution.
Right.
He didn't own a bond insurer's firm. He was not involved in real estate, as far as I know.
Exactly.
What he stole, or what he was accused of stealing, was not even one-tenth of 1% of what the banks and the corporations have taken out of the city. I've mentioned the wholesale restructuring of the auto industry, the steel industry, that took place over a period of decades, not only in Detroit, because Detroit was the center of industrialization in the United States and indeed the world, but this happened all over the United States, cities like Gary, Indiana, and cities like Youngstown, Ohio, were severely impacted by this deindustrialization. Then, of course, we had the rise in profits for the most wealthiest corporations. They utilized finance as a profit-making mechanism in and of itself, not necessarily to purchase goods or to produce goods and services, but just to make money for the purpose of maximizing the rate of profit. So we've had an overall decline in wages. And there's been an overall decline in social wages as well. The quality of life of people in the cities, in many neighborhoods and communities, have declined tremendously over the last decade or even more. So this is a nationwide problem. The president dances around it. He measures it but he never goes even close to the core of the problem. And that is that the class division of the United States is widening, and that more and more of the resources of the local government, state governments, and even the federal government are being consumed by the banks, the financial institutions, and the multinational corporations. So, yes, we have to do whatever we can, utilizing PRN, FM, other forms of alternative media, social media, leaflets, street rallies, petition drives, whatever we can to get out this information. It's crucial because
Well, we have a bunch of questions lined up, is also waiting. So,
if I could just get a follow up question real quick, and I'll take my answer off air, Mr. Ziegley. Now,
is this DX?
Yes.
Is this DX? Really, we have a bunch of people.
Just wanted to see if he or anybody on his behalf. He's very articulate.
Has what? Hello.
I think he cut off.
Oh, jeez. Sorry.
Well, I'm still here.
Okay. Jay from New York, you're on the air.
Yes. Good afternoon to you, Utrice, and your guests.
I just have two
quick questions. Number one, have they started repaying the banks back the money? And also, I had heard a couple of weeks ago that there was talk that some nonprofit institutions came together to say that they would save the arts and also help with saving the pensions. Is there any truth to that? And I'll listen off there.
Thank you, Jave. Thank you very much for your call.
Yes. Yes, they've been paying the banks. We've been paying the banks for years and years, and we've got nothing out of it. That's what's driven the city and the financial ruin. That's why we had called for a moratorium on debt service payments to the banks. It was declared by Orr, interestingly enough, last June, 3 months after he was appointed as emergency manager. In order to take those debt service payments and utilize them for the continuation of services in the city. When we had made this demand to the city government, they had acted as if we were advocating treason, you know, not to pay the banks. Even the interest on the loans, they thought it was inconceivable. Well, of course, it was taken up. And, of course, but they used this in order to institute even more draconian programs against the city of Detroit. And in terms of the question about the philanthropic organizations, we're studying these proposals right now. But in regard to the Detroit Institute of Arts, one of the early articles that was written in response to like the Knight Foundation and several other foundations that supposedly has offered over $300 million for ostensibly the protection of the Detroit Institute of Arts and also to contribute to the pension fund. There was some mention of the transfer of the ownership of the art to another entity or trust, and we oppose that completely because when you hear the word trust, that's usually utilized in reference to the banks, and trusts are set up in order for very wealthy people to transfer their wealth to successive generations without being overly taxed and regulated. So we would oppose any transfer of the ownership of the Detroit Institute of Arts to a private entity and any other asset in the city of Detroit. But we do welcome any assistance, but it cannot come with strings attached.
Also from New York, we have Lincoln. You're on the air with Aboyomi Azikiwe.
Hi, good day. Good day again, Utrice.
Thanks
for that great elucidation on the topic. And I would love, before I make my comment, I'd love to find out how we could all get a transcript of this great, insightful dissertation. I want to say that I think our main problem, and it was also intimated in your discourse, that the problem is we the people, are not recognizing the purpose of government. The purpose of government is to serve the people. Someone said it very succinctly when he said about Obama. He said Obama is just interested in being president. He said he just enjoys being president, but he doesn't have any conviction. And How could Detroit go bankrupt in the United States of America? And how could one city go bankrupt? And we are saying the United States of America. People are failing to recognize that government should not be for profit.
But Lincoln, you need to ask a question.
No, I just want to make a comment, and then he can speak on it, you know.
Okay. All right, we'll allow it. Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree that the government should service the people, but over the last several decades, that has been changed in terms of how the purpose of government is articulated, even by those within the government. For example, I've heard repeatedly from President Obama that the government cannot create jobs, that only the private sector can create jobs. Well, this is not true because if we look objectively, beginning in the first part of the last decade, a lot of the job growth took place within the government, particularly after 9/11 with the expansion of Homeland Security. They created a lot of jobs. Now, some of those jobs are under threat because of the sequester and the so-called budget deficit. I also wanted to mention that the bankruptcy of Detroit was a tactical move on the part of the emergency manager and the banks and the corporations who backed them because they wanted to stave off massive litigation that was being filed against the emergency manager, which could have held up the process for months, if not years. So in filing for bankruptcy, it placed a stay on all the litigation against emergency management on the basis of the Michigan State Constitution and also the U.S. Constitution. Now all the litigation against the city of Detroit has been stayed, and it has to come through the federal bankruptcy court judge, Stephen Rhodes. So it was a tactical move. There was never a payless payday for workers in the city of Detroit. There was never a payless payday for the pensioners. The buses were still running, albeit at a slow level. Public lighting is in crisis, but it never totally collapsed. The water department, which is one of the largest water systems in the United States, is a multi-billion-dollar generating, revenue-generating system that services not only Detroit but the entire region of southeastern Michigan and other areas of the state, which is now being threatened with privatization. So it has nothing to do necessarily with the fiscal health of the city, although the fiscal health of the city has been driven into ruin as a result of the predatory lending of the banks in regard to municipal finance, destruction of the housing stock and the decline in jobs, but it has to be viewed within the context of tactics that are being used by the large financial institutions and their agents in government to further suppress the people, to bust the unions, to privatize city services, and to seize public assets. It has to be looked at in that context.
Thank you for your question. Well, that brings us close to the end of our program today. Abayomi, could you talk a bit about what is next in this court case?
Well, right now, they have to go into the fairness and equity phase of the trial. The governor and the emergency manager and the people who are backing them want to wrap this thing up. They were really shook up when they lost the trial to pay off UBS and Bank of America and Merrill Lynch. To the tune, they had negotiated it down to $165 million. It had started out as high as some $250 to $280 million. By the way, Barclays, we had to get that revealed as well, will be paid $4.4 million just in administrative fees for arranging the loan, and albeit the city of Detroit is bankrupt. So we're preparing right now for this fairness and phase of the trial. And that's when the whole question of the pension cuts, the ownership of the DIA, the Detroit Water and Sewage Department, the Detroit Public Lighting Department, all of that will come into being. And what we're working on is drafting our own people's plan of adjustment, which, of course, will challenge the plan of adjustment, which Kevin Orr, as emergency manager, has to put forward before the bankruptcy court, and it has to be approved by the court. And it appears as if there may be an opening now to fight against any proposed cuts in pension as well as health care. He did put a stay last week on the cuts in the retirees' health care plans, which was scheduled to take place at the end of February. So we have to see how all of this unravels. And we will be in bankruptcy court. We'll be in the streets and the communities, of course, advocating on behalf of the people of the city of Detroit.
I was going to ask about the reaction at the grassroots level. Is there some indication that the discontent is growing and that people are becoming more, not just vocal, but more active?
Yeah, I think the defeat of the Barclays swap deal gave people a lot of inspiration and hope. More people have been coming to meetings. We have a response of Martin Luther King Day every year downtown in Detroit, and people came out last Monday to Central United Methodist Church in great numbers, and they were very enthusiastic because people have been demoralized. They've been beaten down. The courts have not provided justice. The media is constantly attacking the unions, attacking the residents of the city, championing the banks and the corporations and their wholesale theft of jobs and threats against the pension. So it's going to take a lot more to win this overall war, even though we did experience a victory in terms of this battle involving the swaps. But I'm sure they're going to come back with another deal or another program that they can sell to the federal courts and try to sell to the public in general. And that's what we have to be on guard against.
Well, I want to thank you again for this very instructive session. You have given us an incredible panorama of the whole debacle, not just the local translation of it, but also, you know, throughout the country, and even the connection to what's happening on the world scene. So this is very, very, very important. It's very important to watch the developments in the city of Detroit. I want to thank you again, Abayomi, for being with us today.
And you're very most welcome. And, of course, we really appreciate your interest in this issue, providing an objective platform for us to put forward our ideas and to talk about what we're doing here in the city.
Thanks again. Well, tomorrow we will have another presentation on the P word. It's the P word that our president doesn't like to say too much about. It's called poverty. So we'll be talking about that. We have a special presentation tomorrow and a major, major presentation coming up on Friday as well. Stay tuned. Keep it right here at PRN.FM. Coming up next is Dr. Jack Rasmus with Alternative Visions. You can write me at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lee. Thanks so much for being with me today. I hope this program was of value to you.